If you love monks and clerics in D&D, but have wondered if you could combine them in a way that would make for a powerful character who could bring amazing control and damage and support to your party, then guess what? You can. And you should totally watch this video to see how. Welcome to D4. Hey everybody, so here at D4, each week we take a deep dive into one, sometimes two, specific character builds for our favorite tabletop role-playing games. We crunch numbers about them, we theorycraft about them, not so that I can tell you the right way or the best way to play a certain character, but to just explore one potential way to build something that will hopefully be both really powerful and also really fun to play in-game. So if you enjoy creating characters for your role-playing games almost as much as you enjoy playing the actual game itself, or if you're just looking for tips or ideas on how to build something that you're thinking about playing, then welcome home. This is where you belong. And I'm so glad you're here, so thanks for being here. My name is Colby. Did you know that I made a series of videos to teach people who are new to the game how to play D&D? I did. There is a playlist right up here that I call D&D University, and inside that playlist you'll find 5 videos that teach people who don't know how to play D&D or who could use a refresher on the game everything they need to jump right into their first session. So if you're a person who feels like you could use a refresher, or if you have someone that you'd like to introduce this wonderful game to, then I'd really appreciate it if you would take advantage of those videos and share the love. Thank you. Insert generic comment about like, subscribe, comment, ring the bell here. So, another Dungeon Dudes multi-class tier ranking video came out a few days ago, as of this recording anyway, a couple weeks ago for those watching, and I think that means another build that was inspired by my good friends Kelly and Monty. For those who somehow may not know, Dungeon Dudes are doing this really great series ranking the multi-class options for every class. Check it out right here. And I think it's a really fantastic series. It's a fun conversation to listen in on, and it leads to a lot of fun speculating and brainstorming on their part, and, well, on mine too. I think of all the multi-class options that they discussed in that episode, my favorite one to think about was the Cleric Monk multi-class. When you first think about combining these two classes, it feels like there might not be a lot there. Conceptually, sure, but mechanically? I mean, one likes to punch stuff, the other is an armor-wearing support caster. But the more I started to think about it, the more excited I got by a couple of different possibilities, actually. I mean, first of all, both classes want wisdom, so there's some decent starting synergy there. And while most monks still need dexterity or strength for their damage, there are a couple of ways that we could get damage out of just increasing our wisdom, which means we could be relatively sad, right? Single ability score dependent, which could actually then lead to both some decent damage and some fantastic support capabilities, not to mention making things like Stunning Strike a lot more reliable. What I ended up making was something that I think is both really cool thematically, but also mechanically. Now, as is my wont, I'm actually going to be building this character with an eye to their damage, specifically their sustainable DPR damage per round. And I feel like I need to maybe say this, and it's probably something I'll repeat a lot every time I do something that the Dungeon Dudes inspires me to do. I'm definitely not trying to prove or disprove whatever score they gave a particular multi-class combination. I happen to agree almost completely with just about every score they end up giving, with very few exceptions. I'm really just kind of drawing on them for inspiration and having a lot of fun trying to think of things that might potentially be exceptions to like a low score, or just ways to combine two classes that I hadn't really thought of before that might be fun and potent. This particular character is going to be pretty decent at healing and supporting and buffing if they wanted to be, sure. But their real strength, I think, will come in the form of control. We're going to be locking down multiple enemies on the battlefield, potentially, doing some really decent sustained damage to several of them each turn if we wanted, though I'm going to be focusing on just single target damage, all while having the fun and flavor of mixing my favorite class in the game, conceptually at least, monks, with one of the best support characters out there in Cleric. The result? D&D build number 137, the Sagacious Wrestler? The Wise Guy. Oh, a wise guy, eh? How about the Cosmic Controller. Huge thanks to my good friend Randall Hampton for the fantastic artwork that he created for this build. He does this each week. If you would be interested in following him on social media to check out the other stuff that he's done, all of which is amazing, or just to reach out to him to see if you could commission him to create some art for your character or your party, I will put links in the video description as always. Before we jump into the build though, I want to tell you guys about the sponsor today for the video. It is DealDash.com. I know a lot of you are probably already bidding on DealDash, but for those of you who don't know, DealDash is an auction website that people really kind of either seem to love or hate. If you've seen any of their admittedly somewhat annoying ads on TV at any point during the last 15 years or so, you will know that they have thousands of auctions every single day with brand new items where people have literally won auctions for things like an iPad for $13.24 or an Xbox for $45. So what's the catch? How are they getting these things for so cheap? Well, the way it works is you've got to pay up front to bid. So for instance, after you sign up, they will ask you to buy, for example, 400 bids for $30, which means you can bid 400 times in any of their auctions. If you win the auction, of course, you still got to pay the price of the auction, so you're kind of paying for bids, and then if you win, you're buying the thing at an amazingly great deal. Every auction starts at $0 with no minimum reserve price, but every time you bid, at the most, it just raises it by a penny. So after you bid, the auction timer counts down by 10 seconds, and if no one bids in the next 10 seconds, you win the auction. You can do it on your phone, you can do it on your desktop. Here's an example of me bidding on my desktop just a few minutes ago, trying to win an iPhone.
All right, I'm winning. Come on, 7 cents for an iPhone. Come on, come on. Oh, somebody outbid me.
They have all kinds of crazy things that you can bid on. This brand new Jeep, someone won for like not even $1,900, and this Nintendo Switch bundle for $22. So, all right, let's say you sign up, you have 200 bids, cost you about $20 for them. You spend all those bids, you don't win anything. Well, you can use their buy it now feature and then just flat out buy the thing at the buy it now price, and they will return you the bids back into your DealDash account so you can use them again to bid on more of their auctions. So, is DealDash for everybody? No. Some of the auctions can take hours or even days to end, so you have to have time to invest in the bidding. Also, they don't ship internationally, so for those who are outside the US or Canada, it's just not gonna work. But if you like bidding on auctions, and you've got some time on your hand to figure out how it works, you can get some really sweet deals. If you're interested, check them out here at this URL, deal-.com/D4. That's how they'll know I sent you. If you sign up, use my promo code D4 and you get 100 free extra bids on the first bid pack that you purchase. Also, if you don't win an auction using these bids, or if you don't like it for any reason, just contact DealDash and you'll get your money back on that first bid pack purchase. No questions asked. So you've got almost nothing to lose. Check them out. Again, deal-.com/D4. Big thanks to DealDash, and let's jump into the build. All right, level 1 for our cleric monk. We're starting fighter. I know, you guys hate me so bad. Right, so I'm not sticking to like Kelly and Monty's rules here. Again, I'm using them for inspiration, not saying we have to start at cleric and be mostly cleric and then we can dip into other classes or whatever. That said, by the end of this build, we are going to be more cleric than anything. And I think this build, frankly, does totally work if you just wanted to start cleric. It's a pretty different build in that case for the first several levels, but if you want to focus more on your support than anything, you want to buff and heal and maybe throw out some cantrips for damage, right? And then later on develop some martial capabilities, you totally should, and I think the character would be great. I think they work a little better if we start out with our martial stuff first and then add cleric stuff later, especially with our focus on being a controller, right? So that's the route that I'm going. And since I do want to be really good at punching stuff, I think just starting out with a single level of fighter does a lot to make our early game a whole lot stronger than it otherwise would be. We're going to want some fighter levels later on this character anyway, actually, so yeah, it just made the most sense for me to start here, meaning that yes, when we first meet our champion, they are a humble soldier or mercenary or city guard, etc., but in our case, one who has felt called to something more. They're unsatisfied with the life they're currently leading. I think they're feeling a pull from the stars. Something out there is giving them a yearning to leave behind the mundane trappings of a material world and expand their consciousness into something greater than themselves. For our race, we are not going variant human or custom lineage. No, we want half-elf. Even though this character will be relatively sad for a monk, right, we do still want a good ability score in three abilities, and half-elf is, I think, the best way to get there. Plus, yeah, sure, I'll say it now, elven accuracy, always a nice option to have access to. For the sub-race here, again, I'm going to recommend either wood elf or drow elf. Drow is maybe especially good thematically, I think, as we'll see later, with their fairy fire and darkness and dancing light spells, but I just love Wood Elf here for the extra move speed that will actually be pretty important for us, mechanically even, as we will discuss later. For our ability scores, I'm assuming the point by method as always and say, let's go 15 wisdom and take our plus 2 there, a 15 dexterity, plus 1 there, and yeah, a 15 constitution and our final plus 1 there. We don't need no stinking strength or intelligence or charisma. No, we are healthy, agile, and above all, sagacious. And yes, I absolutely love starting out with a plus 3 modifier in the three stats we actually care about. And it's super serendipitous that they're also the three most important saving throws for any character, right? It feels like the stars have truly aligned in our favor here. As for equipment, I'm gonna say let's start off gold buy and go scale mail and then either a rapier and shield or a heavy crossbow. We're not gonna be using this stuff for too long, but it will make life a lot easier at level 1 anyway. So yeah, for now we want the typical trappings of the fighter life that we will soon be leaving. One important note, I don't usually talk about it, but for skill proficiencies, make sure you take proficiency in athletics here. That's going to be really important for this character. As a fighter 1 then, we get second wind, which lets us heal ourselves for a d10 plus our fighter level as a bonus action once per short rest, and then we get a fighting style, and this is actually maybe the main reason I wanted to start fighter, because thanks to Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, we have access to the very lovely unarmed fighting style, which tells us that our unarmed strikes can deal 1d6 plus our strength modifier in damage instead of the usual 1 plus our strength modifier, and better yet, it's a 1d8 if we aren't wielding weapons or a shield, which we won't be very soon. Plus, if an enemy is grappled by us, we can deal 1d4 damage to them at the start of our turn. They don't get to save against that or anything. It's not a ton of damage, but it's free damage. So okay, at early levels, this is a decent little bump to our unarmed strikes once we actually start making them. Currently, our strength is terrible, so I don't know, maybe we had a lot of practice getting scrappy with our siblings when we were growing up, but as the runt of the family, our technique was decent, but our actual ability to hurt the bigger kids in a fight just wasn't quite there, maybe. Anyway, to be fair, this isn't a ton of extra damage, but again, it will make our early game better and will still provide some benefit for us throughout our career, so yeah, I'm happy to have it. But at level 2, yes, we have decided to answer the call of that voice that's pulling us to a different path. We've decided to leave behind our material possessions and focus on things beyond this world because we are now taking monk levels. And at monk 1, first up, we get the unarmored defense feature, which is going to lower our armor class. Well, okay, actually, if we were using a heavy crossbow and then scale mail before, as opposed to a rapier and shield, our AC is just gonna be the same. Except now, we can do it naked. With unarmored defense, our armor class is equal to 10 plus our wisdom and dexterity modifiers combined, if we're unarmored and not using a shield. So yeah, it's a 16, same as scale mail plus 2 from our dexterity, right? And sure, we could just keep the armor and weapons for now if we wanted, but if we decide to go without, while we might be lowering our AC, we are effectively going to be doubling our damage because we also get martial arts at monk 1, and this tells us that if we are unarmored, unshielded, and attacking with only unarmed strikes or monk weapons, then we get the following benefits. Attacks with unarmed strikes and monk weapons can use dexterity instead of strength now. That's nice. We can roll a d4 in place of our monk weapon or unarmed strike damage, but of course we went with the unarmed fighting style, so that means our attacks are a d8, which is great. And then, importantly, when we take the attack action with an unarmed strike or monk weapon, we can make an unarmed strike as a bonus action. So now we have two attacks on our turn, each for a d8 plus our dexterity modifier, and that's pretty impressive for a level 2 character. At level 3, we would be a monk 2, and that means we get unarmored movement. If we're unarmored and not using a shield, again, we get an extra 10 feet to our move speed. This will always be handy, but especially for us, I think. More later. We also get ki at monk 2, which tells us that from now on, we have one ki point per monk level, and these reset on a short rest. We can use these key points for three things at the moment. Step of the Wind and Patient Defense let us spend a key point and a bonus action to dash or dodge, respectively. And then Flurry of Blows lets us spend a key point to make two unarmed strikes instead of the usual one as a bonus action when we take the attack action. And that's really cool. Right now, we could only do this a couple of times per short rest, so it's not super sustainable. But I think once we get like 4 or 5 key points, we could probably consider it sustainable, since my requirements to call something sustainable damage is that we can do that much damage per round for at least one entire combat encounter. And yeah, most combat encounters at a typical D&D table only last 4 or 5 rounds, right, on average. Here's my favorite homebrew rule to help monks out with their key points, because like most critics of monks, I just don't think they get enough of them. Just give them proficiency bonus plus their monk level and key points. It's not a ton more, but I think it's just enough to make it feel less scarce and like you can use them a little bit more liberally, right? Especially at those early levels. At level 4, we'd be a monk 3, and that means we get deflect missiles, which tells us that when we are hit by a ranged weapon attack, we can use our reaction to deflect the arrow or whatever, reducing the damage by a D10 plus our dexterity modifier plus our monk level, reducing most attacks at this level anyway to 0 or near 0, which is awesome, and even awesomer, it's not a word. We can spend a key point, if we want to catch and then redirect that missile, which just really scratches that Kung Fu master itch so perfectly. We also then get our monastic tradition here, our monk subclass, and in case you haven't been able to deduce from all of the hints I've been dropping, yes, we are going with the Way of the Astral Self. This is just so perfect for everything we're trying to do with this character, both mechanically and thematically. I don't think I've ever read the description we get for this subclass from the official wizard's text, so indulge me here for a moment, if you will. A monk who follows the way of the astral self believes their body is an illusion. They see their ki as a representation of their true form, an astral self. This astral self has the capacity to be a force of order or disorder, with some monasteries training students to use their power to protect the weak, and others instructing aspirants in how to manifest their true selves in service to the mighty. Now, the word astral here doesn't have to mean relating to or coming from the stars, like Webster's dictionary defines it. It could simply be in reference to a supposed non-physical realm. But I think, for me, it would have more that traditional meaning. So my astral body would be kind of like star-like and twinkling, I think. Anyway, as an astral self monk at level 3, we get our most important feature here, the Arms of the Astral Self. With this ability, we can spend a key point and a bonus action to summon our astral arms. Having these arms out gives us a number of really cool and important benefits. First up, when we summon them, each creature of our choice within 10 feet of us has to make a dexterity saving throw or take 2 times our martial arts die in force damage. That's just 2d4 for now, but not a terrible little AoE for a bonus action and a key point when it's something we wanted to do anyways. Thereafter, for the next 10 minutes, we can use our wisdom modifier when making strength checks or saves. This is super important for us. We can also use these arms to make unarmed strikes. Also important, as our reach for these strikes is 5 feet greater than normal, giving us a 10-foot reach. And yeah, if we would have gone bugbear here, we'd have a 15-foot reach, and yes, that would be super awesome. But even better, we can also use our wisdom modifier for unarmed strikes with these arms instead of strength or dexterity, and the damage type for them is force. Okay, there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, This is why we get to be so sad on this character, right? Focusing almost exclusively on wisdom, and that in and of itself is super awesome. Secondly, it's a huge component to what's going to make us such a great controller. My vision for this character at this point is to be grappling on our turn, right? Remember, when we grapple, we take the attack action, but instead of trying to hit something, we substitute one of our attacks, assuming we have multiple, which we will later, with a grapple check, which is typically, yes, a strength based athletics check made against an enemy's athletics or acrobatics check, right? Well, now we still make an athletics check when we grapple, but if we have our arms out, since that typically uses our strength modifier to impact the roll, it will now use our wisdom modifier. Now, although there's nothing here that tells us that we can use these astral arms to be grappling with, so don't try that without discussing with your DM first, we can grapple with just our regular arms, using our wisdom modifier, and then still have our astral arms free to punch with, which would, yes, use our wisdom modifier to hit and damage. And that, frankly, is amazing. Don't forget that you need a free hand to grapple, but we could be potentially grappling two enemies, right, and then still be punching, whether punching our grappled targets or anyone else within 10 feet of us, all with our wisdom modifier. And sure, I suppose if we wanted to go Loxodon here, we could be grappling three enemies, or even more on a Simic hybrid, but I'm happy with the potential for two. Now, the reason that our move speed is so important is that when you're grappling an enemy, you can still move about dragging them, but you do so at half move speed, right? I imagine that there will be many times that you'll have one enemy grappled and you'll want to get over to a second, but they're like 20 feet away. Well, thanks to our high move speed as a monk and a wood elf, it'll just make getting around the battlefield a lot easier, even when dragging unwilling participants. All right. The first phase of our sad controller is complete, but I want to stick with the monk here for a couple more levels for some important additional benefits. So, at level 5, we would be a monk 4, and first up, that means we get slow fall, which I love. It just tells us that when we fall, we can use our reaction to reduce the damage we would normally take by 5 times our monk level, which equates to 50 to 60 feet on average that we could fall without taking any damage at all. So graceful. And then we get an ability score increase or feat, and yeah, you knew it was coming. I want elven accuracy, so we can bump our wisdom by 1 here, taking it to a lovely 18, and then also get to roll 3 dice instead of the usual 2 when we're making an attack with advantage. Favorite feat. So good. At level 6, we would be a monk 5, and that means we get extra attack, and as much as I would have loved to start taking cleric levels earlier, I just couldn't imagine delaying extra attack any further. I mean, now we can potentially grapple 2 enemies on the same turn with our wisdom modifier, and then still make unarmed strikes with our wisdom modifier. It's just kind of huge to have 2 attacks every turn, right? Alternatively, we could just grapple 1, and then with our second attack, we could take the shove action and try to knock them prone. We've talked about this on the channel before, but this would again use our wisdom modifier on that athletics check to shove if we had our arms out. If we were to do this and be successful, of course, then since the enemy is grappled, their move speed would be 0, and since standing up from prone requires half your move speed, well, they'd be effectively pinned to the ground and couldn't get up until they broke your grapple check, right? Also, if they're prone, their attacks would be made with disadvantage, and ours would be made with advantage, and that's just so much happiness, especially for those of us with elven accuracy. Keep in mind, too, that again, grappling enemies and shoving enemies do require that we take the attack action. We're just taking the attack action and then substituting an actual weapon attack with a grapple or a shove, right? This means that, yes, we can still make those bonus action unarmed strikes, which require that we take the attack action, whether we're spending a key point to flurry of blows or not, and that's some really wonderful synergy as well, letting us still hit our enemies even when we're spending our turn trying to control them. Hooray! The other incredibly important feature we just had to get to Monk 5-4 was, of course, Stunning Strike. That wonderful and oft disappointing feature that lets us spend a key point when we hit an enemy with a melee weapon attack, and yes, unarmed strikes count here, to try and stun them. The target gets to make a Constitution save, unfortunately, which means many enemies will often succeed, but man, If they fail, they are stunned until the end of our next turn, and that means incapacitated, so no actions or reactions or bonus actions for that matter, no movement, auto fails on strength and dexterity saving throws, and all attacks against them have advantage. So very, very good when it works. So very, very sad when it doesn't. I guess that's the way Wizards tries to keep it balanced. All right, so at level 6, it's time for our first damage report. Let's talk about what I think combat is going to look like for us at this level. On round 1, I think we're getting out our arms with a bonus action, right? Then probably running up to an enemy and grappling them and then shoving them with our second attack to knock them prone, or grabbing a second enemy if there's one nearby. After that, we're probably shoving prone if they're not prone, assuming we've got a couple of them, right? And then making unarmed strikes with our astral arms. Once we have as many enemies as we want grappled and on the ground, we're just using all of our actions and bonus action to hit as often as possible, which I will assume will be 4 times in a turn for us at this point. Meaning, yeah, we're blowing that key. Here's hoping you're getting lots of short rests. Now, one great thing about the build is this. We could have 2 enemies grappled and prone and then make unarmed strikes with our astral arms to anyone else that's within 10 feet of us, right? Or maybe drag over 5-10 feet and make attacks. We've got a decent move speed, so we could reasonably get within range of another enemy or two if we really wanted, which is great. Best of all, I mean, theoretically, at least, we could have 2 enemies controlled, grappled, prone, and then make unarmed strikes against 4 different targets, attempting to stun each of them. Well, okay, let's see. 1 key point to get our arms out, 1 to use Flurry of Blows, meaning we'd have 3 key points left to try and stun 3 different targets in a single round. I mean, I don't actually imagine this happening all that often, if ever. It's rare that you're going to have 2 enemies grappled and then be within 10 feet of 3 others to try and stun them, not to mention have the key points to actually do that. It's fun conceptually, and it's theoretically possible. When it comes to crunching numbers, I'm just going to assume that we are making 4 attacks against a single enemy that we've got grappled and shoved prone. I think you should seriously consider taking more turns to grapple more enemies and spending at least some of that key to try and stun like a third target, because that's just so fun and powerful. But as I am beholden to the spreadsheet and want this build to look as good as possible against other builds as I can, in case you didn't know, check the video description. I always put links to graphs and spreadsheets that compare these builds that I do to one another. I will, as always, be exploring best case scenario for damage here, just to see where we stack up. Oh, don't forget that we do get that d4 of damage once per turn against one of the targets that we have grappled as well. And thus, against an enemy with a 10 armor class, we would on average do 39 DPR here, once we've got that target prone on the ground, right? And against enemies with a 15 AC, it would be a 38 DPR. And compared to other sustained DPR builds at this level, that's pretty dang good. I'd call it like bottom half of tier 1, maybe top half of tier 2. So yeah, if you wanted to do some pretty solid single target damage, you totally could. If you wanted to lay down some pretty severe control on the battlefield, you could do that too. And if you want to do a little of both, you totally will. I love it. Let's see what happens next. All right, so level 7. Most of the time when you play a monk, you really want to get to monk 6. This is primarily for the key empowered strikes feature, which makes your unarmed strikes magical for the purpose of overcoming resistance, as well as a subclass feature that we would get. One great thing about the astral self monk, of course, is that, like I've said, our unarmed strikes are force damage, and force damage is one of the least oft resisted damage types in all of D&D 5e. Hooray! Sorry, I've been watching too much Bluey lately. So getting to Monk 6 wouldn't be quite as important for us. We could have gotten the Visage of the Astral Self at Astral Self Monk 6, but that's mostly utility stuff. It's not bad, but I have delayed cleric levels for too long as is. Now is the time when our character's fascination by the stars and things not of this world are kind of taken to a new level. I don't know that they necessarily have to, like, get religion here. You could, of course, find out that the thing that's been calling you to something higher and beyond is a deity, Helm or Saloon, for example, but I think it could be more secular than that if you wanted. Perhaps an ideal or a cause, or maybe devotion to some unknown cosmic power or force or spirit or energy. Figure it out for yourself and even talk it over with your DM, but whatever your reasons, yes, we're taking cleric levels here. And this means that at cleric 1, we get our subclass, our divine domain, and you already know what I'm taking, don't you? And you're mad about it, aren't you? Now, cut me some slack here. I've only used Twilight Cleric a couple of times, and never for more than a few levels. Once in the full-time healer build, and once in the Shadowblade build. And the Twilight Cleric levels were really just there for the dim light thing. I mean, how can I be an astral self monk and not pair them with Twilight? Come on. Okay, yes. Twilight Clerics are really strong. Many, if not most, who are veterans of 5e would argue that they're overpowered. And I don't necessarily think that they're wrong. If you and your DM need to do some things to temper this subclass, go right ahead. And I'm honestly here more for thematic and damage purposes than anything. But I won't look a temporary hit point machine gift horse in the mouth if you're offering. Feel free to go another route here. I legitimately think you could make this build work with just about any cleric subclass, but Twilight is the best. So, assuming you're sticking with me here, as a Twilight cleric, we get Eyes of Night, which improves our dark vision out to 300 feet. Yikes. And even lets you share that dark vision with wisdom modifier number of allies for an hour once per day, or more often if you spend spell slots. Okay, that's kinda too good to be called a ribbon feature, but it's this subclass's ribbon feature. We also get Vigilant Blessing, which gives advantage on the next initiative roll that one creature you touch makes, including ourselves. You can only have this on one target at a time, but there's otherwise no limit to how many times you can do this in a day. I'm going to assume we've got it on ourselves. We've got a round to set up our control stuff, right? So let's try to get it all going as quickly as possible so we can start pummeling, yeah? We also get proficiency with heavy armor and martial weapons here, but fortunately we don't need either of those, so now I have one less really good feature from this subclass to feel guilty about. As for the spells we get at Cleric 1, Twilight Clerics get Fairy Fire and Sleep for free. Fairy Fire is a pretty strong first level spell, potentially debuffing enemies so that you and your allies have advantage on attacks against them and they can't benefit from invisibility. But we're going to be using our concentration for something else. Sleep is great at very early levels, but it's probably too late to make much use of it anymore for us. Other than that, I would take the usual suspects for clerics here, guidance for that extra d4 on ability checks, and yeah, that can include initiative rolls, so we should be going very early in the turn order pretty consistently, which is great. Healing Word for a bonus action heal from range. Bless for one of the best buffs in game, adding a d4 to all attack rolls and saving throws for three of your party members. I'd probably be using my concentration for that right now, unless someone else in the party already was. But one other spell to seriously consider using here would be Bane, the anti-bless, right? Bane lowers the attacks and saves of up to three enemies by a d4 unless they make their charisma saving throw. And considering that most enemies in 5e have poor charisma saves and we've got a solid wisdom-based spell DC, I think Bane's a solid choice here. Most importantly, because we have Stunning Strike, right? And even though Constitution tends to be the strongest enemy saving throw in 5e on average, lowering it by a d4 will often be a difference maker between that stun sticking or not. Not to mention the benefit that your entire party will otherwise get from having enemies debuffed in this way, right? So feel free to throw out Bane instead of Bless here. At level 8, we would be a Cleric 2, and that means we get Channel Divinity, which we can use once per short rest to do one of three things. All clerics get Turn Undead and Harness Divine Power. The first to cause undead to make a wisdom save or be forced to spend their turn running away from you. The second to let you recover a spent spell slot once per day. But the third, and probably best and probably overpowered use of our Channel Divinity that Twilight Clerics get is, yes, the oft-maligned Twilight Sanctuary. This lets us spend an action to emanate a 30-foot radius, that's huge, sphere of dimly lit twilight. It's centered on us, it travels with us, and it lasts for 1 minute when it's active. If a creature ends their turn inside the sphere, you can just choose to either end a charmed or frightened effect on them or give them temporary hit points equal to 1d6 plus your cleric level. Now, to be fair, as I discussed last week in my invisible hypnotist video, I mean, that's only 5.5 temporary hit points on average for now, not a ton, especially at this level, right? And it does require an action to get going, and it can only be used once per short rest. But yeah, it's still really, really, really strong. It scales fantastically with every cleric level, has a massive range, and doesn't even require us to spend our bonus action or reaction once it's up, or limit how often it can be used. I do think that Wizards of the Coast overshot the mark a bit with this one. And I mean, that's to say nothing of the ability to end frightened or charmed, right? Anyway, like I say, if you need to temper this a bit at your table to keep things properly tuned, go ahead. For us, it's going to do a lot to keep your entire party safe, and there's a high likelihood that they might love you for it, so long as none of them were planning on trying to regularly provide temporary hit points or anything, right? So yeah, make sure you check with your party beforehand, of course, and make adjustments accordingly if need be. At level 9, we would be a cleric 3, and that means second level spells. We should totally grab aid for a nice heal, plus more max hit points on 3 of our party members, and lesser restoration to cure all kinds of bad things, but Twilight clerics get 2 spells for free here. See invisibility, which is nice when we need it, and then honestly, the main mechanical reason I decided to go Twilight cleric here was for the Moonbeam spell, which is typically only available to druids and a couple of paladin subclasses. It is just so gloriously perfect for what we're doing. So yes, with this spell, you can cast it as an action. It requires concentration, and then it fills a 5-foot radius, 40-foot high cylinder with pale silvery light. When a creature starts their turn in the area or ends their turn in the area, they have to make a constitution, yeah, I know, saving throw, or take 2d10 radiant damage. We can use our action later to move it up to 60 feet if need be, and it scales fabulously at 1d10 per additional spell level that we upcast it. All right, there are a lot of mechanical things to discuss here, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. First of all, as a reminder for many of you, but in case you didn't know this, yes, the way this works in-game is that if a creature starts their turn in the area of effect and if they're moved into the area of effect on a different turn, say yours, for example, they will take the damage both times. Some of you don't like this. I don't make the rules, I just understand them. Check the Sage Advice Compendium for clarification on this if need be. Just do a search in that document for Moonbeam, you'll find it. If we have an enemy or two grappled, there's no reason why we couldn't, on our turn, pull them out of the Moonbeam area, and then shove them back into the Moonbeam area, causing them to take damage from it on our turn, and then causing them to take damage at the start of their turn as well. That's amazing. Sure, it's a constitution saving throw, but the beauty is they take half damage on a save, and that really adds up to some decent damage regardless of their saving throw bonus. Especially if they're taking that damage twice in a round, right? Something else. It's a 10-foot diameter cylinder, so yes, you could conceivably have 2 enemies grappled and be moving 2 of them in and out of the area every turn, right? So long as they're touching at least 1 square that's at least half covered by the spell's area, assuming we're playing on a grid here, they're gonna take the damage. This is going to have a big impact for our level 9 damage report. So yes, now we have another round of setup, potentially. And yeah, for that reason, you might find all this setup distasteful and would rather just start grabbing bad guys and punching stuff. To you, I would say, go for it. Your damage on subsequent rounds would be less, but especially in a short fight or in one where controlling your enemies is a lot more important than doing more damage to them, it's for sure a valid tactic. If we're trying to maximize our damage in a medium or longer fight though, here's what we're doing. Round 1, cast Moonbeam over an enemy or two if we can get it, and then get into position to grapple them. This isn't a wasted turn or anything, they're going to take some damage from that spell when they start their turn. On round 2, you grab the squirrely enemy who moved out of your Moonbeam, knock them prone, and drag them back in, making some bonus action unarmed strikes while you're at it. After that, you pull them out, pummel them 4 times, and drag them back in. Now, yeah, again, you could potentially be doing this with 2 enemies, and that's glorious. Moonbeam damage 2 times to 2 enemies every round. It would, of course, require you to spend more turns grabbing and shoving before you could use all of your turns punching, but it might absolutely be worth it, depending on where the enemies are located and what the rest of your party is doing, right? I'm going to just assume, like last time, that you're focusing on single target here, keeping in mind that grappling 2 enemies will very often be better for your entire party when you can make it work, and will, eventually anyways, lead to more total damage per round, though some of it would be done to a secondary target, right? Note, I'm not even using Twilight Sanctuary here. You absolutely could and should if your party needs it and you really want to bring some additional support to what's going on. I'm just focusing on single target damage. You've got options. But against an enemy with a 10 armor class here and a plus 0 to their constitution saving throw, we would on average do 55 damage per round. And against enemies with a 16 AC and a plus 6 to their save, it would be 51 DPR. And that's still really great, keeping us in like a similar place as last time, bottom half of tier 1, upper half of tier 2. Cosmic controller doing work. And again, you could and often should be throwing out those 10-foot reach unarmed astral stunning strikes when you have the key for it and an enemy in reach who has a decent chance of failing their save against that stun. And yeah, like I've said, we are just grade A support with our Twilight Sanctuary alone if we have it available and have decided to take an action to get it going. Not to mention all of those fabulous cleric spells, healing, curing, it's awesome. At level 10, we would be a cleric 4, and that means another ability score increase or feat, and we've just got to get that wisdom capped, I think, so let's raise it to 20, since it impacts literally everything. Our hit chance, our hit damage, our grapple and shove success rate, our stunning strikes, our spell DC. Not to mention an important saving throw, right? And our heals. I love being wisdom sad. That's so good. At level 11, we would be a cleric 5, and that means we get destroy undead first up. Now, if we use turn undead on undead enemies of challenge rating 1/2 or lower, if they fail their save, they don't just run, they explode. Zombie guts. And then we get the wonderful third level spells, which means Aura of Vitality and Tiny Hut for free as a Twilight Cleric. Man, even their free spells are so good. Aura of Vitality, one of the best out of combat healing spells in game, especially I think. It requires concentration, but over a minute it just heals 2d6 damage every single turn for 70 hit points of total healing on average over that minute. Super nice. Tiny Hut is a great utility spell to let you find a little bit of relative safety in an otherwise sketchy neighborhood to maybe take a rest in, right? Revivify feels like a must-have to me for our first resurrection option. Motivational Speech can give us some nice temporary hit points before combat starts, and especially if you're not going to be using Twilight Sanctuary. Dispel Magic is super great to keep your allies safe, but Spirit Guardians is my favorite third level cleric spell, and one I've had my eye on this entire time. Now imagine, you've got a Twilight Sanctuary going in a 30-foot radius around you, filling the area with a dim purple glow. And now, you've got an inner circle of spirit warriors. Maybe they take the form of constellations for us, I think, wrecking havoc on all who have the great misfortune of being within our wrath. Any enemy within that 15-foot radius takes 3d8 radiant or necrotic damage at the start of their turn, depending on your alignment, unless they make a wisdom save, in which case it's half. They also have their move speed halved. Good luck actually going anywhere if they're prone, right? Even if they manage to break your grapple, they gotta stand up, half their move speed, and now they've got a minus 10 feet to their move speed. They're hosed. The damage on this spell increases by 1d8 for every level you upcast it. Okay, so at this point, the question now becomes, do we use Moonbeam for our concentration or switch to Spirit Guardians? That all depends. I mean, Moonbeam potentially does more damage, but it's a smaller area, and the enemy gets a constitution save to take half damage, right? As opposed to the typically better, for us, wisdom save of Spirit Guardians, right? The reality is this. I think in-game, if I've got the spell slot, I'm probably going Spirit Guardians. Being able to grapple multiple enemies, stun potentially multiple different enemies, and keep all of them inside the area of effect of this spell is just kind of the dream that I built this character to be able to achieve. It's so fun and so potent. That said, if you were just trying to maximize single target damage, you'd stick with Moonbeam, thanks mostly to the way that you can drag them in and out of the spell's area of effect every round, and thus double up on the damage. We couldn't do that here with Spirit Guardians, right, because it just is a 15-foot radius around us, so dragging an enemy around isn't going to move them in or out of the spell's area of effect. We'd need to be pulling them with like a Thorn Whip spell like I did on the Nature Cleric video. I don't know if I have any cards left, but if I do, There. Again, in-game, I'm probably going Spirit Guardians more often than not, but for the sake of number crunching, I'm gonna assume that we're doing Moonbeam here, and to be fair, generally speaking, it's a more sound tactical choice to focus more damage on a single enemy than spreading out damage amongst multiple, right? That's not always the case, but it often is. Regardless, you do what works best for you and makes you the most happy. But at level 12, now that we've got Spirit Guardians, finally, and third level spell slots, generally, I think we need to dip back into Fighter for a second. There are two main things that I want here, so yes, we would be a Fighter too. The first thing that I really want is Action Surge, right, which we get at this level. Anytime you're either trying to do burst damage or have a round of setup to get your full rotation going, or really just any time at all for any character ever. This ability is just so dang invaluable. Once per short rest, we can take two actions instead of one on our turn, and yeah, this means that right on round one, we could, say, get our astral arms out with a bonus action, doing a little bit of damage, cast Moonbeam, run up, grapple an enemy, shove them prone, and drag them into the Moonbeam's area, all in the same turn. We've done some significant damage to them already, and controlled them super effectively, and now, right on round two, we can just start pummeling. So good. But I want one more fighter level, so level 13, fighter 3, so that we can get our subclass, our martial archetype, because yeah, we're a grappler, right? So much of both the damage we do and the control we bring is reliant on grappling, and in that case, it's just really hard to not be a Rune Knight, which is of course what we take for our subclass here. Since Rune Knights get the amazing Giant's Might feature, which lets them proficiency bonus times per day grow to large size for 1 minute as a bonus action. In case you've forgotten, you can only grapple enemies who are one size larger than you or smaller, which up until now has limited us to large creatures. Now, with this ability, we can grapple huge ones, and that just really allows us to go to town on all but the largest, you know, gargantuan enemies. Hopefully someone in your party has Enlarge Reduce, and then you could even do gargantuan. What's more, we now have advantage on strength checks and strength saving throws. But wait, you might be saying, we're using wisdom for our grapple and shove checks, so this doesn't help us. Au contraire, mon frère. You see, the arms of the Astral Self ability simply tells us that we can use our wisdom modifier in place of our strength modifier when we make strength checks and saves. It most definitely does not say that we use our wisdom instead of strength for athletics checks or anything like that. Grappling and shoving are athletics and thus strength ability checks. We have advantage on those when Giant's Might is active. Also, with our astral arms out, we can use our wisdom modifier in place of our strength modifier for the bonus to those checks. You might not like this. You might think it's cheesy. You or your DM may rule differently at your table. The rules would indicate otherwise, is all I'm saying is all. And this is actually so good for us that you may well have wanted to go Rune Knight before you even started taking cleric levels, or maybe after you got the Moonbeam spell. Our damage looks better the route we went, but of course I'm also just assuming that your enemy is grappled and shoved when you're punching them, right? And in reality, that won't always be the case. This will help ensure that it is the case more often. But I also didn't want to delay cleric levels any more than I already was, since that was kind of the whole inspiration for the build in the first place, right? You do what you think best for your character and your party. Oh, also, don't forget that Giant's Might lets us do an extra 1d6 of damage once per turn when we hit an enemy with a weapon or an unarmed strike. So yes, I will assume that we've got this going when I do damage reports, even though, again, it takes a bonus action to get going. Hopefully you can do it before combat begins. Let's not forget either the amazing and wonderful Rune Carver feature that we get here that lets us carve two runes into our clothing, I guess, here, which would then empower us in some fantastic ways. I think we've got to take Cloud Rune because it might be my single favorite ability in all of D&D 5e, letting us, once per short rest and with our reaction, cause an attack that one creature within 30 feet of us gets hit by to instead be directed at a different creature within 30 feet. And if you somehow missed the one shot I did with the Dungeon Dudes and with Chris, Triant Monk, where I used this ability to banish an enemy into the Nether Realms, then you really need to see it. Start here. You know what? I'm gonna cut a card that I had before to make sure that I can link that. For the other rune, though, I think I would go Stone Rune here, and this might be the first time I've ever recommended that rune, though it's really good. Stone Rune is great in that it lets us use our reaction to force an enemy within 30 feet of us to make a wisdom save or they are charmed by us for a minute. And in this charmed state, they have zero move speed and are incapacitated. So good. They do get to save against this effect at the end of each turn, but yeah, we're just adding some really fantastic additional control options to our already very controlly punchy selves, and I love it. For our level 13 damage report, since last check, we have capped our wisdom score, added third level spell slots for more, in our case, moonbeam damage, though we could and often should be using spirit guardians instead. We've picked up action surge to just let us get into our rotation a lot more quickly, and even added potentially an extra d6 of damage once per turn thanks to giant smite. But against enemies with a 10 armor class here and a plus 0 to their con save, we would on average do 73 dpr, and against a 17 ac and a plus 7, it would be 66 damage per round. And compared to other sustained damage builds that I've done to date at this level, it's kind of slipping just a skosh by comparison, putting us a little more solidly in just like middle of tier 2, which is still phenomenal, honestly. And again, is just so great considering how much support and control and area of effect damage we can potentially be bringing to the fight. At level 14, I've got to get back to Cleric. Scaling our spell slots is the best thing for our damage here, plus at Cleric 6, we get to use Channel Divinity twice per short rest, which just means lots more temporary hit points for our entire party, since we're big fat cheater faces. Or, I guess, more spell slots or zombie guts for those of you with integrity. We also get Steps of the Night as a Twilight Cleric, because if there's one thing this build was missing, it was concentration-free flight. Seriously, talk about the gift that just keeps on giving here. Right, so with this feature, as a bonus action, when you're in dim light or darkness, which should be nearly all of the time for us, thanks to Twilight Sanctuary, we can fly for 1 minute. Not once per day, proficiency bonus times per day. Fun. Now, sure, you could get up into silly grapple fly drop shenanigans like we did in the dive bomber build, but I'm not going to assume that that's what we're doing. If you want to try it out once in a while, sure, go for it. I'm sure it will be awesome and hilarious. At level 15, we would be a Cleric 7, and that means 4th level spells for both upcasting Moonbeam or Spirit Guardians for more damage, but also Aura of Life and Greater Invisibility for free as a Twilight Cleric, both of which are so good. Aura of Life doesn't heal for a ton, but it has that same huge 30-foot radius, and for 10 minutes it gives resistance to necrotic damage for all of your friends inside the area, keeps them from having their hit point maximum reduced, and lets them recover 1 hit point at the start of their turn if they're unconscious. It's kind of the ultimate bounce your allies back from unconscious spell. And the best part is that it happens on your ally's turn, right? Letting them immediately stand up and start doing stuff. As opposed to what often happens where, let's say, you heal your ally on your turn, but then they get hit again by a bad guy before they have a chance to do anything, right? And just go unconscious again. Greater Invisibility is the ultimate be invisible and still do stuff spell, like we took advantage of last week in that Invisible Hypnotist. But beyond that, Banishment, I think, is great for control. Death Ward is fantastic for support, keeping an ally from dropping to 0 hit points once at any time during the 8-hour period in which it lasts. Nothing we're going to be using for damage here, so have fun with it. Pick your favorites. At level 16, we would be a Cleric 8, and that means an ability score increase or feat, and I think I would bump Dexterity here to help out our armor class, not to mention our stealth and initiative and saving throws, etc., etc. Also, Destroy Undead works now on undead creatures of challenge rating 1 or lower, and then we get Blessed Strikes, which is the option from Tasha's that I would use in place of the typical Divine Strike here. This tells us that once per turn, when we hit a creature with a weapon attack, yes, unarmed strikes count, or do damage with a cantrip, then we do an extra 1d8 of radiant damage. And then, finally for us, at level 17, we would be a Cleric 9, and that means 5th level spells, and Twilight Clerics get Circle of Power and Mislead for free, Circle of Power is a pretty potent support option, otherwise only available to paladins. It requires concentration, but again gives a 30-foot aura that allows you and your friends to have advantage on all saves against spells and magical effects, and if you make your save and would otherwise take half damage, you instead take none. It's like better than evasion in some ways, worse in others I guess, but worth considering in some heavy magic fights especially. Mislead is a fun utility spell that lets you go invisible and conjure an illusion of yourself that you can direct to act and speak as you, though it ends if you attack or cast another spell, so it's really just kind of utility focused, right? Aside from that, other 5th level spells worth considering, I think you've got to take Greater Restoration for a real cure-all. Raise Dead in case you can't revivify your fallen ally within the 1-minute time limit of that spell, right? Maybe Flame Strike for some not quite as good as Fireball area of effect burst damage. Wouldn't be bad to have that option once in a while. But again, nothing we're using for our sustained DPR, so PYF. For our final damage report then. Since last check, the main thing we've done to increase our sustained DPR is just to scale our spell slots for more moonbeam damage. We did add a D8 once per turn from Blessed Strikes, and then of course greatly increased our defensive, support, and utility options as well. But against enemies with a 10 AC and a +0 to their constitution save here, we would on average do 97 damage per round. And versus an 18 AC and a +8, it would be 85 DPR. And that lands us in a similar place to last time compared to other sustained DPR builds I've done to date at this level, kind of middle of tier 2. And again, with everything else we bring to our team, that's kind of incredible. We are almost averaging 100 DPR. At least against low AC enemies. And since that's an average, sure, there are going to be times when you will do over 100 damage in a single round for multiple rounds in a fight, all while you lock down targets and give your allies, what, 12 or 13 temporary hit points every single turn? Crazy town. All right. Let's break it all down in some final thoughts here. The tier score for this character, if you take the damage that they do at all of the armor classes and saving throws that we calculated at each of the 4 damage reports, and just average it all into one big number, we get a 57. And that puts them right near the top of tier 2, just under the Pokemon trainer who is the current leader at 58 for tier 2 builds, and just above the Crit Fisher. And that build was like an all-out barbarian fighter paladin that was really just there to do one thing and one thing only, hit stuff and smite when they crit. We're outpacing them damage-wise on average. And we're a fantastic support and control character to boot. I don't know what else to say. Is this a B-tier character? No way. I'd have to give them an A at least, maybe an S. Of course, the point of this exercise isn't to be like, I can't believe the Dungeon Dudes gave this combo a B, it's way better, right? I mean, anything paired with a Twilight Cleric, first of all, is going to be super strong by default, and you can't really take exceptions to a norm and say that the norm is wrong, can you? Maybe the more important question, then, is this. Is this build better than just an Astral Self Monk or a Twilight Cleric if you just went a straight class build with either of those subclasses? I think with a Monk, the answer has to be a resounding, unequivocal yes.
I don't think it's necessarily better than a straight up cleric. I think it's actually better than a straight up monk, though.
As for the cleric, the answer is more likely a maybe. If you're primarily looking to heal and buff and support your allies while throwing out a little bit of damage, then no. But if you want to bring some top-notch control and amazing single-target damage along with your really strong support, then abso-freaking-lutely. So that's the build for the week. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I'm really grateful to Monty and Kelly for providing all the fantastic inspiration that they've been providing me with lately. But I am even more grateful for you guys. I love you guys. Thank you for all that you do, for me, for the channel. I could not do this without you. I hope you have a fantastic day and a really great week. And if you don't, then I hope you'll hang in there. You can get through this. I also hope that you stay safe and that you're good and kind and that I see you again very soon. But until then, take care. Trailer for sale or rent, rooms to let 50 cents, no phone, no pool, no pets, ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means, by no means king of the road. Growing up, we used to listen to Roger Miller all the time. It was like my dad's favorite artist. He's kind of an old school country music guy. Famous for Robin Hood. He was the rooster in Robin Hood. So like, you know, Robin Hood and Little John running through the forest. That guy. Don't you love it when you get through about 5 minutes of recording and realize that you forgot to push the record button? I don't. I don't love that, actually. Every town has its ups and downs. Hair. It's all over the place. Stay still. Sometimes ups outnumber the downs, but not in Nottingham. Stop reading. Just look at the camera. I'm inclined to believe if we weren't so down. All right, that's enough. How about a peanut butter sandwich? Shel Silverstein, the king about the peanut butter sandwich. I don't know. For some reason, every time I hear or say those words, how about, the next lines out of my mouth always must be a peanut butter sandwich. I hate it when I forget to put my phone in airplane mode. Well, don't say that. I am the father. Best Father's Day present ever. Oh, it's even got the kids' names. You can't really make them out, but... Nope, don't say that. I already said that. I don't even need to do the sponsor because I already recorded it. Woohoo! Grappling and shoveling. Who are we shoveling?